You're listening to the What Happens Now podcast with me, Mike Oldham. Everyone's been affected by the coronavirus outbreak in many different ways. We don't want to focus on the negatives, so I'm going to do my best to bring a little bit of positivity your way by speaking to a different guest each week about the positives that might arise out of this whole situation. The issue of the environment is one that's cropped up in several episodes of this podcast already, and it's been a mixed bag in terms of positivity. On the plus side, pollution and emissions are down as everyone's been forced to stay home and ditch the car, and there's been a lot of positive reports about cleaner air, burgeoning wildlife, and nature generally bouncing back over the course of the past couple of weeks. But at the same time, the experts say it's not enough. 2020 is still expected to be the hottest year ever on record, and it's likely the emissions would have to drop even more than they have over the past couple of months every single year for the next 30 years to have the necessary impact on keeping temperatures down. Quite a scary thought. You've probably already heard of the environmental movement Extinction Rebellion. What does an organization like that do when they can't be out in the street? And does a crisis like this create more challenges for them, or might it present them with exactly the opportunity they need? I thought it'd be interesting to speak to Andrew Medhurst, the leader of Extinction Rebellion's finance team, to find out how he got involved, what's been happening with Extinction Rebellion during the COVID crisis, and what he thinks we can do to try and create a more positive future for the next generation. Great stuff. So hello, Andrew. How are you doing, and how have things been during lockdown?
I'm great. And lockdown for me, I think initially the first couple of weeks of lockdown were not hugely different from pre-lockdown, because I tended to spend most of my day in front of a computer doing various stuff in my volunteer role for Extinction Rebellion. That continued for a number of weeks. So it rather felt like other people were in lockdown and I was still carrying on as before. But in the last couple of weeks, I'm now starting to feel, okay, I'm in lockdown. It's going to feel like I'm in lockdown. And I absolutely recognize my privilege, right? I was volunteering before this, so I haven't lost a job. I'm not in a situation where the economic impact, which I think has affected most of us, has affected so much that it's causing me sleepless nights. So I recognize my privilege. And so far, it's been an interesting experience.
And how have you been keeping busy? Have you been doing things for Extinction Rebellion, or have you been off duty?
Yeah, no. So as I mentioned, in those first few weeks after lockdown, I was still very much feels like I'm doing a full-time job. In fact, sometimes over the last 6 months since I've been involved with the finance team of Extinction Rebellion in the UK, it's felt like I've worked harder than I used to work when I had my career in the City of London. 10, 12-hour days sometimes, 7 days a week, always doing something, no real time off. So I think from that point of view, it's been busy. I could elaborate more about what's been happening at Extinction Rebellion when it comes to money. Clearly, the COVID virus pandemic has impacted us, our ability to be on the streets. When we're on the streets, we raise a lot of money from the general public. So conversely, when we're not on the streets, the money tends to dry up because of, you know, we're out of the news cycle, really.
Yeah. I mean, most people that are listening, I would imagine, will at least have heard of Extinction Rebellion, if not already know what they are. So I don't think we'd need to go too deep into it. But just for the uninitiated, generally, what is Extinction Rebellion and what's your particular role in it?
Okay, so Extinction Rebellion formed or was launched on the 31st of October 2018. Last year, 2019, they had two rebellions on the streets of London, tens of thousands of people coming down and taking part in non-violent direct action, non-violent civil disobedience, in support of three demands of government: tell the truth, act now, act as if it's an emergency, and then form a citizens' assembly, because we want a democratic adult discussion about what we need to do to basically address the problem that we find ourselves in. I personally wasn't there on the 31st of October 2018, the launch date, but I sat on Waterloo Bridge with my wife and dog in November 2018. And I suddenly felt this was something that I could get involved with. It felt like it was something I'd been waiting for. I gave up my job, 30 years in the City of London. I was working in pensions at the time. And I've pretty much been a full-time volunteer with Extinction Rebellion since late February 2019. For the last 6 months, I've been pretty much leading the Extinction Rebellion UK finance team. And to put that into context, Extinction Rebellion raised about £3 million last year.
Oh, wow.
And at the start of this year, was spending somewhere of the order of £200,000 a month.
before that, before you got involved, had you done anything similar at all before, or was it really kind of chalk and cheese?
Well, yes. So I would have considered myself an activist, not a sort of professional activist by any stretch of the imagination. I was always, I think most people would claim to be, to care about social justice, whatever that means. Let me just pick two of the things that it manifested for me, my activism. I was passionate about the human rights of Palestine and Palestinians, and I was passionate about anti-war. So I was very, very much involved in protesting against the invasion of Iraq in 2003. I took a day off work. I would have thought around, when would it have been, 2009, 10, whenever Tony Blair gave evidence to the Chilcot Inquiry,
okay, yeah,
about the Iraq invasion. I took the day off work and stood outside and shouted outside Queen Elizabeth Exhibition Centre in Westminster. So for me, it was about anti-war, justice for Palestine. They were the sort of ways in which my activism manifested itself.
Okay. And just thinking about the numbers that you mentioned of raising money, those are big figures. Those are kind of like a business, an organization, a company kind of figures. Is that how it's run? I mean, when you see Extinction Rebellion on the news, there's an element of, and I don't mean this in an unfair way, but there's an element of kind of chaos behind it, because that's almost a deliberate chaos.
Absolutely.
But there must be some kind of strategy behind it. Is there a plan behind these things, or is it just about getting people together and trying to disrupt to pressure the government?
So Extinction Rebellion would openly admit that it would not exist if other environmental NGOs were doing the job that we think is necessary. So, for example, we love Greenpeace, but in our opinion, that has become a bit too NGO. Highly paid executives, that their ability to really pressure government, pressure the powerful forces in the economy and in society, are diminished by the fact that they have almost become part of the establishment. So effectively, you look at the environmental movement and you basically say the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, formed in 1988 by the world's governments, over the last 30 years, it's been a failure. I mean, with respect to the environmental movement, some wonderful people, including many people, I'm sure, who are now in Extinction Rebellion. If the world recognizes global warming as being the problem that it was in 1988, 1990, and carbon emissions are 40, 50, 60% higher today than they were then, well, if that's not a failure, I'd like to know what the definition of failure is.
Yeah.
So from that point of view, Extinction Rebellion is filling a gap. Like a lot of activist movements, they exist because there's not sufficient action being taken. And so we don't want to be an NGO. We've managed to raise a lot of money, that's true. But we don't do bosses. We don't have an executive board. We don't have a CEO. We are chaotic. That's absolutely the case. I'd like to describe it that we're almost like this sandbox of experiments. Who would have known in April last year, a pink boat in the middle of Oxford Circus would have caused this news explosion around the world? There was a lot of money raised during that period of time because a lot of people recognized, yes, this is exactly what needs to happen. I can talk through the theory of, you know, nonviolent direct action, nonviolent civil disobedience. It's in the traditions of Gandhi, Martin Luther King. At the end of the day, it's worked before, and we're almost in the last chance saloon when it comes to action on the climate. That's why we're thinking nonviolent civil disobedience today on the streets of London and worldwide is basically the last chance we've got when it comes to taking some meaningful action.
What kind of numbers of people are involved? Do you know? Is it hard to tell?
So here in the UK, it's certainly, I would say, it's my understanding our email list is somewhere of the order of 250,000 people here in the UK. Now, that's people on an email list. Our volunteers giving a few hours a week, I would imagine that's in the thousands, if not a few tens of thousands. So you know, it's relatively small in comparison to the population of the UK. We're hoping to sort of scale that to something like 1 million people in the UK actively involved in either supporting or taking part in nonviolent civil disobedience. But essentially, it's those sort of numbers at the moment.
And how much success would you say you've had so far?
Okay, so these annual climate conferences that get held every year would have been held in Glasgow, I think, this year, but it's been postponed. That would have been COP26. There was a survey done just before COP25 that said Extinction Rebellion was the biggest global influencer on climate activism in 2019. For an organization that didn't exist 15 months earlier, that's pretty significant. And if that cost essentially £3 million, that seems like good value for money. I mean, we don't, you know, it's not just us. Greta Thunberg, who we think is absolutely wonderful, the school strike for climate, for Fridays for Future. These organizations have also been similar, but I think it was non-violent direct action, people being arrested, absolutely unprecedented. In the UK, the thousands of people who got arrested in 2019, it's changed the debate. Nobody can deny that the influence of XR and Greta Thunberg have caused the conversation to be raised a notch or two.
Yeah, and I think I became aware of Extinction Rebellion partly because my old office was on the Strand, so just along from Trafalgar Square, where there were huge demonstrations. But also in the news, things like bridges being blocked and public transport being disrupted and people locking themselves to various things. In general conversations, some people are all for it, but sometimes there's maybe a personal reason that somebody isn't. Let's say you had to get somewhere, and I'm talking maybe even extreme things. You're trying to get to a wedding or a funeral and you can't get through Heathrow Airport or something like that. The negative press, I guess, that comes from that, is that a challenge to Extinction Rebellion, and how can you kind of get over that or get round that?
Well, let me answer that question in two different ways. So clearly there are stories of, I mean, there was one story last year when somebody on their way to hospital to see their dying parent, a dying father, I think it was held up, failed to get to the hospital, as a result didn't see their dad before they passed away. Clearly those individual stories are absolutely regrettable, and Extinction Rebellion would be absolutely sympathetic, empathetic, and sorry for those stories. But in my life as an activist, it's not that other things haven't been tried and have failed. Signing petitions, writing to one's MP, marching on the streets of London. There's a friend of mine, Amir Amirani, made a film about the global protests ahead of the invasion of Iraq in 2003. It's called We Are Many. 40 million people around the world protested against the Iraq invasion. I think the numbers on the streets of London were about 1.6, 1.8 million people. One sunny Saturday, 15th of February, 2003, they marched on the streets of London. Lots of people marching for the first time. Nobody believed that Tony Blair would ignore that sort of number, the biggest protests on the streets of London in a generation, certainly, if not ever. It was ignored. The problem of protest, where beautiful, beautiful protests take place, everybody turns up in London, then goes home at the end of the day, politicians will ignore it. It's only if you keep coming back, or in the case of Extinction Rebellion, you camp down on those bridges or in Oxford Circus on a Monday morning, you're still there 10 days later. The politicians will start to take notice when it starts to cause economic disruption and loss to the economy. So unfortunately, I'd love it to be somewhere different to the way it is. We have to do this in order to get the attention of the politicians. And equally, we have to be making sacrifices, personal sacrifices ourselves. So, for example, in my particular case, I was arrested 3 times in 2019. The first time for failing to move when asked by a policeman from Waterloo Bridge. I think it was about 12:30 on the day 2 of the April Rebellion. unless people watching and thinking, what are these people doing on the streets of London? And secondly, oh my God, they're being arrested. And all right, being locked up for 24 hours, but unless they see personal sacrifice, you don't make that connection between people who are oblivious to the climate emergency and people who are saying, we just don't know what else to do.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about the, I've got it circled here, the arrest story.
Well, I sort of mentioned the first arrest. Are you thinking about the third arrest?
I think the third one, yeah.
Third arrest. That was a more interesting one because, so arrest number one was I sat on a bridge and refused to move, right? So it's no surprise when you get carried off the bridge by four or five policemen. The second one, I glued myself to City Hall, standing as an independent in the European elections. Again, not a surprise. The third one was more of a surprise. So the 12th of September last year, I was at home in front of my computer, as I spend most days, when I got a knock on the door. And I've got a sort of intercom thing down to the gate at the end of the drive. And I said, hello. It was a Scottish accent, Mike. And he said, I won't try and do a Scottish accent, but he said, Andrew Medhurst, can you let us in? Now, 2 hours earlier, I'd noticed that one of the co-founders of Extinction Rebellion, a gentleman called Roger Hallam, had just been arrested in East London. And I know why he'd been arrested, because he was telling everybody, journalists, he was posting videos on YouTube, he was going to go to Heathrow and fly a drone and try and shut the airport down. It just so happened at the time, I had been acting as a personal assistant to Roger. I'd also taken on this new role in the finance team of Extinction Rebellion. So I did not expect to be arrested that Thursday evening in Wandsworth, but I knew as soon as they announced themselves why the police had come. I had absolutely no intention of flying a drone at Heathrow Airport the next day or that weekend or whenever. I do wonder whether the police, that's what the police said. They said I was part of this conspiracy to cause a public nuisance. I suspect it might have been seen as an opportunity to confiscate computers and find out what the finance team was doing ahead of the October rebellion, which was just 2 or 3 weeks later.
Have you ever had a situation, this is a kind of hypothetical, I guess, but thinking about that drone, that seems like a kind of another step, doesn't it? It's almost like a step too far or whatever you want to call it. Do you ever feel conflicted with anything that's going on in Extinction Rebellion? Have you got to a point where you've ever thought, actually, no, I don't want to be involved in that? Or do you feel that it's all kept in check?
So that particular action was debated widely throughout the summer of 2019. And in the end, Extinction Rebellion decided that was an action they couldn't support. It would not be an action that would be done in the name of Extinction Rebellion. So effectively, it was a group of individuals, including Roger, who decided to do it independently of XR, and it was called Heathrow Pause. They still felt in their conscience they needed to do it. The expansion of Heathrow was such a massive infrastructural project that would have locked in these carbon emissions for decades to come, that it was seen as being completely contrary to the UK government's commitments in the Paris 2015 agreement. In fact, in the last 2 months, the High Court has ruled against the British government, and the British government has dropped the expansion of Heathrow. But back in the summer of last year, Roger and others decided that it was they almost saw the expansion of Heathrow as almost a genocidal project against future generations. It was neither condemned nor condoned by Extinction Rebellion. That was language. Now, what do I think about lots of things that go on in XR? It's a broad church. There are lots of people. I think that Extinction Rebellion, for me, is the only game in town when it comes to meaningful action for the climate and ecological emergency. I don't feel that I need to agree with everything that happens in Extinction Rebellion. I sit in a number of meetings in Extinction Rebellion and I think, what the hell am I doing here, right? Not because of what they're going to do, because it just feels like a waste of my time. But ultimately, we are bonded together as a group because we just don't know what else to do. Because it's clear that the politicians, governments of the world, are not going to act quickly and dramatically enough without some sort of spark, some catalyst. Whether that's Extinction Rebellion or not, I don't know. But it just feels like if I was to leave Extinction Rebellion, what am I going to do?
How have things been impacted in the last couple of months with the coronavirus and everybody quarantined?
Extinction Rebellion was already... there is a problem with we don't do bosses, right? And we don't have a CEO and a board of directors or whatever. You're quite right, Mike. You already said it feels a bit chaotic. And yes, it is a bit chaotic. And, you know, I was in the finance team and we had a certain amount of money, but we don't do bosses. So in some senses, the finance team didn't feel like it was our job to tell the movement how to spend their money. And if it was there, that they should spend it however they wanted to. It was clear from the beginning of the year that £200,000 a month was not being supported by income. We were last on the streets in October. We were on the streets in Madrid in COP25 in December. General election was on. We were trying to make our voices heard during the general election campaign. But as we moved into January and February, the income was starting to drop off a little bit. So you don't need many months of spending £200,000 and only raising £100,000 to start to feel you're going to have to start tightening your belt. So as we moved into March, we started to plan to cut budgets, but the lockdown, the COVID pandemic, it just caused the income to fall even more steeply than we expected. We weren't allowed to be on the streets from the third or fourth week of March, and hence towards the end of April, we had to sort of cut quite a few of our costs. We haven't got a huge amount of fixed costs, but we were paying living expenses to some of our volunteers. Why do we pay living expenses to some of our volunteers? Well, we don't want to be a white middle class privileged organization. We want minorities. We want single parents. We want people that wouldn't ordinarily be able to be part and volunteer full time for an organization because they don't have the economic means. We wanted to make sure they got some living expenses. So from that point of view, in April, we did have to have a painful decision of basically saying to 150 of our volunteers, I'm sorry, we haven't got any money to sort of pay your living expenses anymore.
Well, I suppose it's like anything. It's like people who are working for a company, whether they're volunteering or whether they're working. It's difficult times, isn't it?
Sure.
What impact do you think that the dropping off of donations, is it largely individual donations that you run on?
Yeah, so I would say, I mentioned a figure like £3 million last year. I would say 60% of those would be small donations from the general public. Median donation would be about £20, £25. But we have had some significant, what I would describe as trust or institutional donations, either high net worth individuals, the band Radiohead, I think were being blackmailed by somebody about releasing some unreleased music. They decided to release all these tracks online, charged their fans £16 each or whatever it was, and donated all the money to Extinction Rebellion. So that raised about £400,000 for Extinction Rebellion.
Wow, that's incredible, isn't it? With those things, especially the small donations from the general public being reduced, what's going to be the impact, I guess, short term, but also longer term? Do you expect them to start coming back in again once people are returning to work, or is it going to be, are we moving into a completely different landscape for Extinction Rebellion?
18 months ago, Extinction Rebellion hadn't got any money, right? It might have had £5,000 in the bank. It was a single donation of £200,000 that allowed us to put on that April Rebellion, the pink boat in Oxford Circus, the Garden Bridge on Waterloo Bridge. That was done with very little money and a lot of creative talent. willing to give their skills and their energy and their time for free. There's two possible ways forward now. There's a, yeah, lockdown is going to end at some point and we will reemerge and we'll be back on the streets and the public will donate money to us. And clearly we need some sort of money to do what we do. But it's equally possible that, you know, we're a new organization, we're growing, spending £200,000 a month, of which three quarters of that may be on 150 individuals and their living expenses. Maybe that was just one of those learning experiences that Extinction Rebellion needs to go through. I absolutely think at this moment in time that there's one of two ways we can emerge, or it could be a hybrid of those two things. But I don't think Extinction Rebellion, at least in the near term, are going anywhere. We still have a situation. We still believe there is a limited window of time to make a meaningful impact on the problem. It doesn't feel like now's the time to give up because of a virus that may impact us for the next 12, 18 months.
Well, if anything, it might even be a new opportunity. I mean, there's been a lot in the news about the government have been criticised for perhaps prioritising the economy above all else, whether that's people's health or whether that's environment health. But that presumably will offer an opportunity. I mean, people are starting to see in a very short space of time, what have we been locked up for about 2 months now? In that time, there has been evidence on the news channels about things clearing up. And I know some of it's been kind of doctored, but even the other day, a friend of ours sent us a picture of a deer running up Morningside Road in Edinburgh, which is just unheard of. And you've seen, you know, videos of the clear water in Venice and the kind of toxic air in China clearing up. If that can happen in a couple of months, it gives a little bit of a genuine insight into what can be done. The problem is that if we race back to work, like the government perhaps want us to do faster than we want to do, we could very quickly get back into our bad habits. So I guess we're at a time where it might really open up an opportunity for Extinction Rebellion.
Absolutely. And I think this crisis, because clearly it is a crisis, is effectively a once in a generation, perhaps even longer, once in a generation opportunity to reset. I mean, I'd encourage all of your listeners to say, what have you learned in the last 5 or 6 weeks? The value of community. I think we probably, I mean, I used to stack the shelves at Sainsbury's, right, between the ages of 16 and 21. I think we look on people who basically replenish the shelves at the supermarkets differently than perhaps we did 2 months ago. I think we're all being challenged to look at what should we in society value as a result of this crisis. I think some of those things would be community, caring professions. I think clearly we'll come out of the other side of this pandemic, but what I'd like to think is that we'll learn, we'll have a chance to reset, we'll see, walking around the streets of a city like London, where we both live, we'll see noticeable changes in pollution, for example. Sadiq Khan, the London mayor today, has just announced whole sections of busy major roads that will just be where public transport or people or cyclists are allowed to use, you know, cars banned from the centre. So in some senses, the economy clearly needs to recover. The question is, how do we recover from this shock? Where does the money go? And I think this is a once in a generation opportunity for governments and populations to decide how we come back from this. You know, if we go back to business as usual, then the opportunity to reset will be lost.
It's really interesting because the last guest I had on the podcast, Mauro Gatti, he started this publication called The Happy Broadcast. And one of the things that he was talking about was his kind of specialty is focusing primarily on positive news, not looking at any of the negative news stories. But in our conversation, he was kind of talking about, okay, reading positive news stories are good for your mental health, but ultimately there's an element of kind of individual responsibility for making life better. And that's an interesting thing that you've just said, especially from the Extinction Rebellion point of view, because I think perhaps wrongly, some people look at it as an organization that just demands that the government makes changes. But actually what you're talking about is individual things that people can do as well as government. And that's, I don't know, it kind of fascinates me, because people can get a little bit carried away saying the government needs to do this, the government needs to do that, they need to do this. And it goes back to, was it JFK or whoever said, ask not what the country can do for you, but what you can do for the country. And I suppose with that in mind, in the context of Extinction Rebellion pressuring governments, but also with people making individual changes, what's realistically achievable in the next year, 5 years, 10 years, do you think?
So let's talk about this individual choices. Big business, perhaps governments, have been very clever over the last 30 years in suggesting that, I use the metaphor, the bamboo toothbrush, right? They've been suggesting that the individual choices you make as an individual are part of the solution. Bamboo toothbrushes are not going to save the world, because everyone has to do this, right? This is not just, even 10% of the population doing this won't be enough to solve the problem. So I would say individual choices are important. If somebody asked me what the three biggest things you can do as an individual to prove that you're serious, and I think this is, for me, this is about credibility. When I appear on podcasts like this, or when I sit on the streets of London and refuse to move, I'm only authentic if people can look at the way I live my life. I still have a car. I still buy a nice computer from Apple occasionally. I'm not living like I'm somebody in the Stone Ages, but the three biggest things I can do as an individual, in my opinion, are to fly a lot less, if at all, to eat a mainly plant-based diet. I'm not saying everyone needs to become vegan, but the eating meat every day and intensive animal agricultural diets that we have are not only healthy for us, but they have a huge carbon footprint. The third thing for me as an individual is to protest my activism. Everything else, bamboo toothbrushes and it might make me feel good. It's going to make zero difference to the climate and ecological emergency that we face. So that would be my first comment about individuals and what can we do. I'm not telling the government to make all the decisions. In fact, I actually don't want the government to make all the decisions. You know, sometimes people talk about this, what we need is something akin to a wartime mobilization. It's a really interesting stat. When people say it's just impossible to make the changes, Andrew, that Extinction Rebellion are suggesting, I say, well, between 1939 and 1943, the US economy went from about 3 or 4%, single digit percentages, to fighting Hitler. To half of the economy was fighting Hitler 4 years later. So we're talking about car factories that were suddenly repurposed to build aeroplanes or tanks. It is possible. There's a historic precedent. But I don't like this sort of wartime metaphor, because that implies governments telling the people what's going to happen. It's why the third demand of Extinction Rebellion is citizens' assembly. We don't have all the answers. There's plenty of clever people with lots of credible answers about what we need to do out there. We don't know which ones the people, democracy here in the UK and worldwide, will decide are their priorities. But the one reason that rationing in the Second World War worked, it felt like we were all in it together. Not that I can remember the Second World War. But my dad tells me about it, right? You know, it didn't matter whether you were rich or poor, you still were entitled to two eggs or whatever it was. Everyone's in it together. At this moment in time, it feels like, as we've seen with some of the Gilets Jaunes protests in France, extra tax on gasoline or diesel impacts the poorer members of society more than the richer members of society. So the poorer members of society are against it because it's not seen as being equitable in terms of the changes that are necessary. So hopefully that answers your question about individualism. The one thing I want governments to do, the one thing I would suggest, is the primary purpose of government is to protect its citizens. The government is not protecting its citizens, including its future generations, against the climate and ecological emergency. It's not taking the actions even the UK government signed up to in Paris in 2015. So they're not protecting us. There would be parallels, I would suggest, in the coronavirus. Government failed to protect its citizens adequately. Perhaps those will be the big learning points, I think, after this crisis dies down or we come out the other side.
And do you feel like progress is being made? Let's take coronavirus situation out of the equation. But the citizens, what did you call it? The citizens...
Citizens Assembly.
So citizens Assembly. Do you feel... Is that something that you feel is a tangible kind of, we can achieve that and we can achieve it soon? Is it a sense of frustration that it's not happening? Or do you feel like you're making steps towards it?
We're making steps towards it, but nowhere near quickly enough, right? So the IPCC's 1.5 degree report, which they issued, I think, in September 2018, that was one of the things that caused me to give up my job, says that we must halve our fossil fuel use by 2030. That's not just in the UK, that's all around the world, right? And then eliminate it by 2050. That's not happening. Progress is slow. I see reasons to be encouraged, but we're only 5 months after the Conservative government won an 80 or 100 seat minority, voted by 40% of the UK population. It feels like our democracy is broken. How do we kickstart that and quickly enough in order to get the people deciding what it is that needs to happen? I'm not sure. So you said at the beginning, Mike, you probably wanted me to be positive. This is a long shot, right? Yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, it's a long shot. I think it's worth my energy at this moment in time, at least for the foreseeable future, because I care about the futures of my kids. But it's a long shot. And there's already a lot of locked in global heating that effectively is going, if we were to not burn one more fossil fuel ever again, the temperature will continue to rise from its current level. The glaciers, you know, Arctic summer sea ice will continue to melt. Have we passed those tipping points yet? Possibly some of them have already been passed. I do feel more alive by the fact that I'm no longer going to work and working in a pension company, which is encouraging young people to save for the next 30 or 40 years. So they've got some money when they're 50 or 60. I do feel more alive that I am absolutely aligning my values and my concerns and my fears for this world. I'm absolutely aligning my energies with something that I believe in. So that's a positive. You know, life is a journey, right? It's not a destination.
Yeah, like I say, despite me saying, let's be positive. But the thing is, it's realism, isn't it? There's certain things that you have to address. And you can't just blindly be optimistic. You have to take stock of the facts that are in front of you and then try to focus on a positive way of tackling them.
Yeah, I mean, so one of the early strategies of Extinction Rebellion was to go out and give this talk. It's called Heading for Extinction, brackets, and what to do about it, ? And one of the reasons Extinction Rebellion gave this science-based talk about the problems that we face and why Extinction Rebellion was suggesting the sort of actions that they were suggesting was because they believe that people need to hear the truth about the situation. There were plenty of people who went, no, let's give three or four pieces of good news for every one bit of bad news, because otherwise you'll depress people and you'll push them back and they'll do even less for the environment than they would have done if they hadn't have heard that. But what Extinction Rebellion realized from taking questionnaires of all the people that heard these talks, the first 1,000 people who heard this talk filled out a questionnaire, they almost switched on some people. So instead of this normal distribution curve where with people getting a little bit more depressed and doing a little less for the environment, they actually found there were a number of people, whether it was 5%, whether it was 10%, who got triggered into, oh my God, I need to do something about this. It was those people that got switched on to realize the emergency. I mean, I think I got the climate and ecological emergency in 2015, which makes me a late starter, right? I'm late to the party. There are people who have been caring about the environment for 30, 40, 50 years. But I was late to the party in 2015, but I still went back and did my job and went on foreign holidays and blah, blah, blah. And it was only 2018 that I suddenly got switched on again. And it was suddenly, oh my God, I think I knew, because most of us are educated. We know, we read the stories and then we move on, right? You read that story in the newspaper, you turn the page, and then you find all those flights that EasyJet are offering for £10 to fly to Barcelona for the weekend, right? It's so you're almost confused by this society that tells you a successful life is what you have rather than who you are. And what you own and what you can pay for and do makes you a more worthy human being than the relationships you have and the jobs that you carry out and the kids you bring up, right? But essentially, I got switched on in a way in late 2018 that I'd never been switched on before, admittedly from a position of privilege. So I recognize that. But if my privilege, George Monbiot says something similar. If my privilege as a middle-aged white guy is to sit on a bridge and get arrested for the climate, I do that with love, gladly, on behalf of people who can't, who don't have that relationship with the police and are just not in a position to do what I'm doing. So privileged middle-aged white guy, we're not all like that in exile. There's plenty of minorities, plenty of working class people in exile. The papers like to say we're all middle class and whatever Boris Johnson called us. But as far as I'm concerned, sometimes people who are a bit more privileged than others are the people who have to be on the front line here in the UK, because it's poor and disadvantaged people in the global south who are on the front line of the climate emergency at the moment.
Well, I think that's sort of a great way to finish up. The only thing remaining is I've been asking the same two questions to everybody that I've spoken to. So the first of my final questions is, what do you miss most from the pre-coronavirus world?
I've missed tennis, right? So I play tennis, and our tennis club, I'm on the committee, so I was part of the decision, but our tennis club has been closed for the last 6 weeks. It's opening, it's part opening this weekend for the first time. So it will be nice to run around on a tennis court for the first time for a while.
Do you know what's quite funny about the environment? You notice little sounds when you're out and about. You notice little changes. You know, people have been talking about hearing the birds singing more, whether they're singing louder or whether it's just we're tuned into them. But the other day, I took Marley, our little boy, out for a walk, and I heard the kind of thwack of a tennis ball. And I thought, I've not heard that for a while. It really did. It just zinged into my ear. The other question that I've got, if things went back to normal tomorrow, what would be the first thing you'd go and do?
I'd probably wander over to that pub just across the road. You know which one I mean, the Jolly Gardeners.
Yep.
And had have a nice cold beer in their garden. So I've sort of missed that ability to have, I've had plenty of beers in my own garden sort of thing, but it's not quite the same. I think that community of sitting with friends and having a nice drink in a pub. I mean, I feel really sorry for some of the businesses that have suffered because of this. And as long as we can do it safely, drinking a pint of lager in a pub again will be a nice way to celebrate coming out of lockdown.
Yep, I would fully agree. And hopefully at some point we can continue our conversation about environment. I feel like we could talk for hours about it. So, Andrew, thank you very much for joining me. I really appreciate it.
Pleasure. Anytime.
Thank you very much for listening to the What Happens Now podcast. The coronavirus outbreak affected us all, and it was responsible for me losing my brand new job as an event director back in March. Because of the date I started, I wasn't eligible to be furloughed, so it really was a slap in the face for me. The positive being that it led to the start of this podcast. I really hope you've enjoyed listening, and if you have, then please visit my GoFundMe page where you can donate and help support the podcast's future and also support the NHS. 25% of your donation will go to the NHS Charities Together, which helps them continue to provide £1 million a day to the NHS. Just visit gofundme.com and search for What Happens Now podcast. Thank you.